ladies and gentlemen, this is our second time at this wonderful festival, but for our newest member on the saxophone, it's his first time. So please welcome Mr. John Wolf. He's in the back.
Hi everyone and welcome to the Stage Left Podcast. Firstly, thanks for the feedback for the previous episode with Ezra Furman. We got a lot of love for that one and Ezra was a great guest. So thank you for Ezra for appearing. This episode is with John Woff of the 1975 and a quick thank you to Dave Wolford and Glyn for sorting out this interview. And thanks to John for appearing. We were promised a room to record this in silence. However, we were let down at the last minute and a hotel in Fitzrovia, which I won't name, who we asked if we could have a room that was quiet that we could record this in, said yes we could, but only, in their words, a dirty room, which they wanted to charge £190 for us to sit in for an hour to record it, which, bless John, actually offered to go halves on it, but on principle I said no, we shouldn't be paying that amount of money to sit in what they described as a dirty room to record it. So we recorded it in the hotel lobby, which means unfortunately for the first kind of 15 minutes or so there is a table sat behind us which you can hear a bit of their chatter. I didn't want to cut any of the conversation out because it's so good, it's such great stuff from John, so we kept it in, but if it's putting you off a little bit, the table goes off about 15-20 minutes. If you want to flick along to that's cool. For 1975 fans listening, please tweet us at the Stage Left Pod, and also let's get a campaign going to get John to play at Newcastle United Football Club as the players run out, because there's a song called Local Hero, which is a famous saxophone solo, which is the song they play when the players run out onto the pitch at the beginning of a match. John said he'd love to do it, so let's get a campaign. So if you tweet us at the Stage Left Pod and Newcastle United Football Club, let's see if we can make that happen. Our next episode, believe it or not, is actually with Wolfgang Fleur, who is a godfather of electronic music from Kraftwerk, one of the original members of Kraftwerk. For those of you who aren't familiar with their stuff, I urge you to listen to their music. It will sound like you're listening to music set in the future. It was recorded 46 years ago. 1975 would not sound how they sound right now if it hadn't been for a band like Kraftwerk. They influenced everything. They influenced the landscape of all music that you listen to right now. And he's an absolute godfather of electronic music. So he's on next week. I'm going to be meeting him next Thursday. And we've also got the Guns N' Roses guitarist Richard Fortus confirmed as well, which is exciting, as well as a couple other ones as well. So you can find more episodes at thestageleftpodcast.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast. Follow us on Twitter at thestageleftpod. And we've got an Instagram account where we take photos of all the people we interview and behind the scenes stuff as well. So here we go. Here's episode 28. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. And what a vantage point we have today. Our guest today is a man who is positioned stage left to the hottest band on the planet right now, the 1975, who in the past year alone have received nominations for Grammys, the Brits, the Mercury Prize, and won Best Album at the Q Awards. Our guest today has played on not only one but two number one albums, the second of which reached the top of the Billboard chart in the United States, a rare and astonishing feat for a young British band, who amongst others are playing at some incredible shows this summer, including Madison Square Garden. Today we'll be finding out the story behind the coolest saxophonist on the planet, the recording process behind the modern classics such as Heart Out. We will discuss solo material, get advice for young musicians, and find out what it was like growing up in such close proximity to the greatest Healy of his generation, a sex symbol, an icon currently adored by millions of screaming fans worldwide. I am, of course, talking about Tim Healy. Who could forget his performance as Dennis Patterson in the 1980s British sitcom Alfie the Saint Pet, or Vic and Bob's quirky comedy Catterick. Certainly not I, and Tim so happens also to be the father of the singer of the 1975 too. What a guy. So what a pleasure it is to say our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than John Woff. Thanks for joining the stage, John. How's
thank
it going?
You very much. It's lovely, thank you. Great to be here.
Good stuff, great stuff. So we're in London at the moment, and you were just telling me that you're over here for a little while, having a bit of rest and recuperation for some touring you've done last year, prepping and gearing up for the Brit Awards.
Yeah, that's right. So we came off tour just before Christmas. That was after UK tour, but then a 9-week stretch in the States. And so we've just had some time off through January and February to just put ourselves back together. So we've got rehearsals next week for the Brits and a couple of other bits and bobs before we head out again in March.
And you're also playing a gig for Warchild, is that right? Is that around the same time?
Yeah, so that's in... it's a small club show. I think it's 500 capacity. And
wow.
It should be great, actually.
Good stuff. And how do you feel about the big shows these days? I mean, we were just chatting before we started recording about what song John might be playing on if he plays at the Brit Awards. But how do you feel about these big shows these days? I mean, you've played lots of high-profile shows. Nerves not a problem anymore, one would assume?
Yeah, not so much. I think... in terms of crowd size and that kind of thing, you acclimatise to that pretty quickly. I think it depends on... The thing that I get nervous about is if something is televised or broadcast live, because then you know that it's going to be watched repeatedly. And you know, so you can't help but feel a little bit uneasy about that kind of thing. But then again, over time, you just get used to it. But then I think as well, if you play a prestigious venue or a festival that has a lot of history, or if you know that there's, you know, even just a handful of people that are important to you in the crowd, I put a little bit more pressure on myself to deliver a stronger performance. But then again, I like being nervous. I wouldn't want to not be. I think it's important, and it's a reminder that whatever it is that you're doing, that it's worthwhile and it means something. And so I'd like having that nervous energy, and I think I play better for it.
What do you do to channel that nervous energy into a positive thing on the day, rather than just kind of pacing up and down? How do you deal with those nerves?
I think just being as prepared as you can be and relax, and I think those two come hand in hand with one another. But then I think you can usually tell if it's shared amongst the camp. For example, playing the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury, everyone was nervous. Everyone was beside themselves, really. But then, because we were all in it together, you have this pack mentality, then you go out and you just do it. And I think, you know, with music, it's such a good thing to channel that kind of nervous energy into anyway. It's inherent of one another, and it feels great as soon as you get out on stage and start playing. And so I don't really know. I've never really had a pre-show ritual or anything, and I just let it unfold and,
roll with the punches.
Yeah.
Cool. Actually, one of the shows that you did, Matt said he was extremely nervous about, was the one with the Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk us through some of the challenges of that particular show, because so every member of the orchestra had their own headphones, so I'm guessing it was everything had to be synchronised to a click track or something like that. So
that's right,
what were the challenges behind that particular show compared to other ones?
I think for the most part it was just getting the in-ears right, what you mentioned there. Because the 1975 show is such a slick performance now, and the routine of it is, it's so well put together and so well rehearsed. So that anytime you add a new element to it, regardless of how big or small it is, it makes quite a significant difference.
Mm.
So obviously with an orchestra, I don't know if it must have been like a 30 or 40 piece ensemble, maybe bigger, everything just becomes so, it's not that it's cluttered, it's just such a huge new addition to what you're used to playing. And so just getting it right and getting it to feel comfortable on stage took a bit of time. But then it was just incredibly satisfying to play with that many people around you and in front of you. And it's such a moving... the arrangements were just so well put together and beautiful.
So how much involvement did you have in the arrangements? So some of the parts were kind of replicating stuff on the record, but obviously there was new parts put together as well. But did the band have an input into that? Or
yeah, definitely. So Han is very much... He overlooks a lot of the... So when we play live, all of us are playing live on stage, but there is a track playing
ambience and things that can't really be performed live. And so a lot of the stems and audio are taken, you know, from the record for the most part. And so Han is, he's very much involved with, this is Adam Han, the guitarist.
Right.
Very much involved in applying that to the live show and our setup. And it's all stuff that I don't really understand. I know loosely what it's doing, but I don't know, I have no clue how it works. But so he was kind of the middleman a lot between the band and the orchestra and the arranger. Especially with Matty, he's very good at articulating what he wants to hear. He might not be using musical terms,
yep,
but he can, you know, he's a very articulate guy, and he's very good at conveying either how he's feeling with music or, you know, or just working with other people. He can really get what he wants out of someone very easily. And so if he is, along with Han, who's, you know, he's very good, he's a very hands-on kind of guy, very technically minded, so the two of them were great to communicate what they wanted from him.
And it was a great show, it went down well, right?
It was amazing, yeah, it really was, I think, honestly, one of the highlights of last year. It was just, you know, it was remarkable.
You spent a lot of time travelling the world in the last couple of years, and you're seeing the world change in close proximity from different perspectives, more than most. Matty even joked that you guys have seen more of America in the last couple of years than Hillary Clinton. And you recently said on Twitter, if you're angry and disappointed, find a creative and awesome vice to express it responsibly. Art and music has even more purpose now. Very strong message there that I couldn't agree with more. What I was going to ask is that with shows like the Brits and the Grammys coming up, that you guys are nominated for, at a time when Trump has outraged so many. So as we're recording this, it's like a couple of days after he's done an interview with Bill O'Reilly, saying, literally calling Putin a killer, and he's got the bans at the airports and stuff like that. So that's the kind of context as we're recording it right now. John, do you sense there's a greater eye on the arts world to be a voice at the moment?
I think so. I think it seems so many people, not that it hasn't happened in previous elections, but so many people are very much engaged with what's going on. And I think if you look at anything significant with, you know, if the political climate or a shift in culture anywhere in the world, it's replicated in art immediately. If the artist is doing their job right anyway. But also just with, I don't think you have to be an artist to indulge in it, to really. I'm trying to think of an example. Say if you watch the news and you're pissed off by something Trump said, even just listening to a piece of music feels different. And so I think it just, regardless of whether if you're the artist or you're a listener or however you're taking in the art, it doesn't really matter. I think it just, the climate of what's going on makes everything more potent. And so I think, you know, if you're not a young artist, you're going to have a huge amount to say. And of course, I think anything that's any political shift or anything, any kind of a scandal involving Trump, it's going to be mirrored in art and expressed. But I just hope it is, you know, responsible, and it's not just an aggressive protest.
Well said. And I mean, how do you think Donald Trump being president will influence creativity in art over the next few years?
I think it's going to heighten it, but I just hope it's done responsibly and well, which I think it's been done so far. If you look at the Women's March,
yep,
it's incredible, because it's an incredibly powerful. And there's almost, you know, there is creativity within that, even if it's like a funny sign or something.
Yeah.
Or like, I saw a great thing online. It was a protest in Glasgow,
right,
and just how funny some of the Glaswegian signs, yeah, were. And of course, it doesn't dilute how they feel or what they're actually saying, but it's still people being creative and funny with their feelings. And these people aren't artists.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think it's...
It's not... Your point is, I guess, that you don't want it to turn into something nasty. You know,
yeah, of course. Like of course it's going to influence young artists and bands. And
yeah. I mean, the focus of... 2 days ago, the Super Bowl was on, and it was all about... all the kind of press coverage was like, if Lady Gaga is going to make that a political statement rather than anything to do with her, like, actual what her performance was like. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting time. Perhaps the only thing that could possibly be good about Donald Trump being president is we'll look back in 20 years' time and see that it ignited the arts world to like create some amazing music, and hopefully it shall repeat itself in that aspect. So your early life, you've come a long way in a very short period of time. You grew up in Newcastle?
Yeah.
Cool, okay, take us back to Newcastle. I mean, paint a picture for us growing up in Newcastle and with your family, your siblings, you know?
So I didn't, my family weren't musicians, aren't musicians, but we had a piano in the house, and you know, when my mum was younger, she was taking piano lessons, and she chose not to pursue it, but it was still, you know, she still enjoyed music and, you know, was listening to it constantly. And so I had, my parents were listening to people like Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks, James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, Carole King, that kind of thing. And so I was around that, and so I was listening to music when I was very young, and I think I started playing an instrument, I think I felt music quite early on, which I think is really important. So even though I didn't really know anything about it, I would still, if I was just a little, you know, when I was a little boy, I'd run around and dance to it and try and sing along, and I really loved just sitting with headphones and just listening to it, and it was something about it excited me, and I felt slightly more than myself when I listened to music.
Wow.
Which is still very much the same now. But then there's this great family friend who I talk about a lot, a guy called George Irving, who introduced me to music that was a little bit more, not out there, but just not straight ahead pop.
Yeah.
So bands like Steely Dan.
Yeah, great.
And then saxophone players like a guy called Michael Brecker, who's one of my heroes. And even like John Coltrane, for those who don't know, he's... easily regarded as one of the flagship tenor saxophone players and soprano saxophone players of jazz music, and a lot of his stuff is very kind of out there, the kind of stuff that a 10-year-old wouldn't want to listen to at all. But because I knew that my family friend George was into it, and I saw him feel inspired by it, I wanted to figure out why.
Wow.
You know, and so he was a huge influence early on, and so then when I started playing the saxophone, it was, I suppose, down to the music that I was listening to because of George. And then I made friends with a really close circle of younger musicians at school who were playing music in and outside of school, playing in bands, playing in like regional youth bands and jazz orchestras and that kind of thing, but then also playing in our own little pop and rock band, playing covers and stuff.
Yeah.
And so it really became very integral to my social life when I was growing up. It was absolutely everything. And again, I was like any other little boy, I was playing football and that kind of thing and playing video games, but it just, none of it made me feel the way that playing music and even just listening to music did. And so as much as my family were into music, they didn't, it's not that they weren't encouraging, but they didn't like put it in front of me or spoon feed me being a musician. It was just something that I discovered more so on my own and with my close friends at school, I think.
Was there anything specific you wanted to achieve from music apart from just playing it and that feeling it gave you? Were you ambitious in regards to making a career out of it, or you know, what stage did it go from something you enjoyed doing to like, oh wow, I could actually do this for a living?
Yeah, I think it was pretty early on that I knew I wanted to be a musician. I didn't really know specifically what kind of musician I'd be, and I kind of went through phases. And I think if you're like 14 or 15 and you play an instrument, in the back of your mind, you do want to be a rock star, but then you grow out of that very quickly, because you know, you think about maybe going to music college or you'll have like a girlfriend early on and think, oh, maybe I'll just be a music teacher in the school and that'll be great or whatever. And so it changes. And I think it took shape more whilst I was at music college, and then in the 3 or 4 years after that, before I started touring, because I think then you suddenly realise that it's all very real. You have to earn some money, you have to pay your bills and look after yourself, but at the same time you're still ambitious, because I think the whole time I've, you know, from the age of even when like I was 10 or 11, I still had at least a couple of friends that were really driven, who wanted to play music a lot.
Yeah.
And back then, you're not thinking of a career, but then you get into your later teens and you're still around maybe a similar circle of people. And they're still playing music, and then you go into music college and everything's heightened a little bit. Then you start working as a freelance musician, then you're constantly surrounded by people who are equally as inspired, or they're better than you, and so you, I think the kind of musician that I've wanted to be has just been inspired relatively to the people that have been around me the whole time. I think that answers your question. I digressed a bit.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I love the detail. And so you grew up in Newcastle, and you Newcastle United fan?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I got this idea in my head that you spent a disproportionate amount of time as a kid playing air saxophone along to Local Hero by Mark Knopfler.
Totally, yeah.
Which, can you play that?
Yeah, I think I played it at like a wedding not too long ago.
Did you? Yeah, so for those who don't know, a Newcastle United football team, they run out to a very, very popular and iconic saxophone solo played on Mark Knopfler's song, who's from Dire Straits. And yeah, I just wondered, if have they ever asked you that as a local hero? Has Newcastle United ever said, come out and play saxophone?
They haven't, though. I'd be lying if I was to say that I didn't want it to happen. I would honestly love to do something like that. It'd be great. But then, so that hasn't happened yet.
Right, 1975 fans, we've got to get a campaign going. Get in touch with Newcastle United. It's a fantastic saxophone solo. He's a local hero. The song's called Local Hero. It's a no-brainer. It's got to happen. So you studied at Leeds Uni, is that right?
It was Leeds College of Music.
Leeds College of Music, yeah. Right, okay, fine. You might have just touched upon this, but how did you see that as a stepping stone in your career? So people who go down that route of going to a music college and then not doing it, do you think that was a significant step, or would you have carried on this kind of progression in your career anyway without that?
Well, I think I definitely would have looked for this kind of work regardless, but then I think if you go to a music college where there's hundreds of, you know, like-minded people doing the same thing as you, who are after the same kind of work, and again, just having that many people who are better than you, because I certainly wasn't the best tenor sax player in my year, but that wasn't the point really. But I think it definitely influences you, because you're surrounded by people who are just, well, it's obvious, who are just other saxophone players, other young musicians that are really hungry to forge a career out of it. And so it was a huge influence. It didn't necessarily directly influence the direction I went musically, because that was more down to social circles, I think. And because I was studying jazz at Leeds College of Music, I did a jazz degree and took on other modules along the way where I was writing different, you know, styles of music and that kind of thing. But it was more down to the circle of friends I had that were between me and Mike Healy that got me into the 1975. But then, of course, I still had to do a lot of groundwork before I got there. And because whilst I was at Leeds, I was, you know, playing. It was me and a friend of mine, Greg Nicholas, who's a trumpet player. We were a two-piece horn section for maybe five or six bands or projects at the time, which, you know, that kind of work and playing in with lots of different people it really does influence you a lot. And so I think it definitely was a stepping stone, because it just because of the people I met, really.
Fantastic. And you mentioned Matty there. He described you as a great friend he grew up with, and you've been playing with him for a number of years now with the 1975. How would you compare Matt to when you first met him to now? How has he developed as a performer and as a writer and as an individual?
So with Matty, he's always had a lot of confidence, like very, very, very confident, and it's one of the first things you notice, I think, when you meet him for the first time. So even when he was 12 or 13, I can remember he seemed older than me for whatever reason, just because of how he carried himself. And I think, I suppose maybe he's grown into that self-belief through his bands and how successful they've become. And then definitely as a performer and a writer and producer, he's really honed his craft. And one of the things I said before is that he's very good at articulating what he wants or how he's feeling. And so for a songwriter, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And so even if he isn't technically minded with music, he still knows exactly how things should sound, and he knows how it works. And so and then also as a front man on stage, he's this extremely charismatic front man, and you can work a crowd amazingly. He's exceptionally charming on stage, and it's perfect for a rock band. Because really, there's not many. I can't think of a current pop band that has their own version of a Matty Healy. And of course, I could be biased, and people can say that as much as they want. But just when you think about it, I don't think there's anyone as rounded or as striking as Matty. And
he's unbelievably talented bloke.
Yeah.
Likes everything. He can dance. He can sing. You know, he's a great songwriter. He can sing different styles. Man, he's sickeningly talented. That guy. What do you remember? What's your early memories of? So, how did you meet him? Did you go to school together?
No, it was through a friend of ours called James Booth.
Okay.
So James grew up two or three doors down from me in a tiny village called Headley on the Hill, which is in Northumberland, which is not far from a farm that Matty grew up in, before he moved down to Manchester, because his parents are from the northeast, and so that's how he became acquainted with James at a very early age. And so it was after I think he'd moved back to Manchester, he would still come up to visit friends. James was one of them. Jamie Squire, who's in the band now as a session musician, and then also a good friend of ours called Kit Muir. When we were growing up, we were all very creatively minded, all wanted to pursue either music or acting or something artistic, and James is a photographer and director now. And so it was through, I met Mike through James in Headley, this tiny little village, and it was just playing FIFA, which was playing PlayStation in Booth's bedroom, and that was it really. I think that's my earliest memory of meeting Matty.
Many great relationships over FIFA. And so tell us about the calls that you got to start playing with the band. So did you go in the studio first to record, or was it live? How did that work?
So the first time I worked with the band I was recording. It was whilst they were recording their first album, so I was playing on Heart Out and a song called Pressure.
Good tune.
So this is in 2012, I think they were recording it, and it was October, November time, and I got a call from Matty, and it was just and I hadn't spoken to him in ages, really. I knew they'd released a couple of VPs already. They were very busy being the 1975, so he was away and everything. And so it was I would see what he was up to online. That was, you know. So he just called out of the blue and just asked if I wanted to play on his album. I didn't know what I was going to be playing. I didn't know if it was going to be a solo or just incidental parts or anything. And they had a studio in Liverpool. It was this old motor museum which had been converted into a recording studio, a great recording studio. So I went in and just played on a couple of tunes, and I'd met the band in very much in passing prior to that, but it was Matty who I knew more.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, James Booth, who I mentioned a moment ago, he was there documenting part of the whole process of recording that album. And it was great because it was just so straightforward and easy, both musically and just obviously socially, because they're great guys. They're very sweet, and
how did you think the styles would merge? Because on paper it's a bit of a kind of two very different styles. Did you have reservations about it, or could you write your own parts, or did they tell you exactly what they wanted you to play, and how did that work?
So stylistically it was kind of straightforward, because a lot of the saxophone players that I really admire and grew up listening to were session musicians that played in pop bands and with pop artists, but were from a jazz background.
Yeah.
So, for example, Michael Brecker, who's a huge saxophone icon, like an unbelievable jazz musician, but then when he plays in a pop setting, he's played with like Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, the list goes on and on. And so he has both sides to his playing, and that's very much the foundation of what he is about. And so that's what inspires me. And so I've always just listened to guys like that. And so going into playing with the 1975, it was like, all right, this is my opportunity to try and be like one of these guys, one of these musicians. I didn't have any reservations at all about it stylistically. And then when it came to it, for example, Heart Out, it was pretty straightforward, because the sax solo is it's just a hook from the chorus. So he would just sing down to me on a talkback mic from the control room what he wanted. With the tune Pressure, and a couple of other 1975 tunes, it was a case of you know, just running four or five takes of a solo, and then at a later date they come together.
They chop it together, right?
Yeah, okay. So they would take the stems and just, you know, make their own arrangement of a solo, which is, you know, absolutely fine with me. Some people might not be too into it, but I was, you know, it was like a huge opportunity and a break for me, so I didn't want to go in and be too strict with what I wanted, because, I mean, who would be in the position to do that given the circumstance? And then, so it's kind of been a bit of both. Like, some of the solos have been, you know, very much dictated by them, but then others, like, for example, there's a tune called This Must Be My Dream.
Yeah, on the second album, yeah.
And that solo was kind of written in my bedroom in Newcastle. And
really?
And it didn't really change at all when we tracked it in LA.
And that was written for the song. When you say you wrote it in your bedroom, that was written for the song? They sent you a demo of it and you had to
That's
play.
Right, yeah.
Right.
And so it's been a bit of both in terms of recording and writing the solos. It's the effort's been quite shared, I think.
Excellent.
Great.
And obviously, talk us through when you first started playing some of the big gigs with them. So what was your first gig with them?
It was at Manchester Academy.
Yeah.
And so it was in January 2014. They had a run of shows. They had 3 nights in Manchester Academy, then 3 nights at Brixton Academy.
Yeah. So you've gone straight in at quite a high level for them. You know, they've done all the hard work and there's not anything that you got involved.
Yeah. And I mean, there was still a handful of smaller club shows on a US run that we did later in the year, which is great. And so I think I still entered at the right time, because it was still an amazing, unbelievable tour for me to jump on, playing academies and bigger theatres. And I mean, I couldn't believe my luck, basically. But I still think I started when they were still very much excited about it as well.
Yeah.
They couldn't believe they were playing Manchester Academy, and they were overwhelmed and, like, you know, crying afterwards, and which is lovely. And so I'm pleased that I caught it at that stage, rather than going in at like an arena level where, albeit still very much amazing, I might have missed some of the really early. Mm. Just like almost like the
embryonic stages.
Yeah,
of that. Yeah. And how did it affect you, kind of going from, you know, playing probably some quite smaller venues to going to playing large venues, mm-hmm. and then people starting recognising you and stuff like that? How did that affect you?
Well, the thing is, I just thought it was so cool and interesting, and the thing, I'm quite a quiet guy. I tend to keep myself to myself, so it was a little bit bizarre and overwhelming and everything. But then, it's still really lovely to be recognised for what you do, and especially now there's not many saxophone players get that kind of exposure or attention anymore, which is a shame. But then it sort of makes sense when there's just not that many saxophone players. That's
yeah,
why.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's great just to have the affiliation with such an exciting and awesome band, and as much as I don't dwell on the attention. But of course, it's only ever been really flattering and really nice, and so I'm not going to pretend that I'm too cool and that I'm going to, you know, shun it off or anything, because it's just really nice. People are just being really sweet and lovely, and they, so it's just been, like, I think just saying it's been really good fun is the easiest way to say it. You know?
Fantastic. And around that time after that tour, I think that's when you put out Flight, your EP, is that right?
Yeah.
Which I was listening to this week. It's a beautiful, like, 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes or so of music. I think 5 songs on there, I think. How was travelling the world at such a young age changing you as a musician? And was Flight written before that period, or was it during that period? I wondered if that record would have sounded any different that you released if you hadn't gone on those tours before. Mm.
Well, yeah, I think touring the world with a massive pop band influences anyone, really. And I think if there's something that you've worked on since you were a little boy, so playing the saxophone, I started playing the saxophone when I was 10. I hadn't stopped working on it up until, you know, today. And it just all unfolded so perfectly and so well for me that it does heighten your sense of, you know, sense of self-belief and confidence and faith in what you're doing. And so it was definitely beneficial to me when it came to writing my own music. And then also just being around musicians like the 1975 or anyone before that as well, because as much as it was influenced by touring with the band, a lot of the guys that played on the EP, the band that I put together, were members of projects that I'd played in prior to touring.
Mm.
And so it was still an extension of everything that came before touring as well.
Okay, cool.
But even just traveling, you know, music aside, when you see a lot of the world, it does change things. It changes how you think. It changes your taste and everything. And so, yeah, it was a massive influence. So what was the second half of your question, sorry?
Well, yeah, actually, I'll go on to that. You have answered the question. That, yeah. What I was going to say is, I mean, it's a beautiful EP you should be very proud of. And the saxophone is on the record is the lead instrument, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's no vocals on there. And when composing these lead parts, are there themes and ideas you want to convey in the same way as a lyricist might? And if that's the case, what are the challenges and limitations around that?
Well, yeah, it's far more interpretive and open because it's instrumental music, so you don't have lyrics to dictate the sentiment of a tune, and so you rely more on, it's not to sound far out, but you rely heavily on vibe and the foundation of the groove, and so a lot of the instrumental music for me, it reminds me of a time or a place or a group of people. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that that's what the listener gets out of it, because you know, that there aren't lyrics to latch onto, or there isn't an obvious sentiment. So it's,
when you're sitting down to write it, is there like that fixed in your mind? Is it, you know, are you ever trying to convey a particular emotion or feeling the same way as a lyricist might, or is it just kind of what flows out?
It kind of varies. I think I don't think I've written enough to have a honed process yet.
Okay.
And so at the minute, it's usually, I think places often influence me a lot. More kind of, because for example with New York, I don't know if you've been to
Manhattan,
but just when you walk around there, you don't have to do anything, but you feel different. There's something, whatever it is, you just, there's a heightened sense of everything. And so if you go out for dinner, it's more exciting. You could just have a drink of anything, and it tastes different to how it would when you're back home. You know, you meet someone and it immediately becomes more interesting because you're from different places. And so I think probably being in different places and traveling is something that really does directly influence the sound, and not necessarily melodies or anything, just the mere simple sound of the music and how it feels to listen to, I think, is probably more influenced by people and places than anything.
Are there any emotions that are hard to convey playing the saxophone because it just sounds too damn sexy?
I think playing a ballad, it has to be put together so tastefully for it to sound good, or otherwise it'll just sound a bit gross and sleazy and everything, because unfortunately the saxophone has that those kind of connotations, and I think that kind of thing is becoming quite antiquated and a bit dated now. But I think anything to do with love or you know, a ballad or anything to do with sex, if you try to compare that with a saxophone, it's just a bit gross, unless it's done very, very tastefully and you know, and it's not too influenced by, I don't know, like Michael Bolton or Kenny G or something.
That's it. Cool. And are you going to record some more EPs, some more solo?
I'm recording one at the minute, yeah.
Oh, nice one. Is that where you're recording at home?
It's been, again, written whilst I was away, and then some of it was written at home, but it's a collaborative effort with a friend of mine that I met at Leeds College of Music, a guy called George Solanos.
Oh, right, okay.
And he's a guitarist and producer, amazing composer, and he's Cypriot. He's been living in Cyprus for, he grew up there. After he studied at Leeds, he went back home there, but now he's just moved to LA. And so he's incredibly busy. I've been really busy on tour, so we've been slowly chipping away at this EP. But it's at the stage now where we've almost finished tracking everything. So over the next month or so, we can start mixing it. But the whole thing's been done remotely.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And so any conversation we've had or any time we've sat down together to write sections of music, it's been done over Skype. Right. Which, as you can imagine, brings many challenges, and you have to have a lot of patience. But the way that it's worked is I'd come up with a demo, or George would come up with something. We'll send it to each other, then we'll work on it on our own, then we'll discuss it over Skype, really, for the most part. And then anything in terms of recording and tracking has been done remotely as well, so I'll send a demo to a bass player or a drummer, you know, that kind of thing. So just really slowly chipping away at it, but it's almost there now. We're getting there. And it's the same similar thing to Flight. There's four or five tracks. It's all instrumental. It's very eclectic already.
And what's George's influence? So you say he's Greek Cypriot. Is that reflected in his music at all?
Definitely.
Because you get some interesting time signatures.
Absolutely. I think anything that's, you know, kind of more Eastern European, or when you get close to like Turkey, then you get some really amazing just the fundamentals of their music is just quite striking, and rhythmically, melodically, harmonically, it becomes really beautiful and complex. And so especially one tune on the EP is really influenced by. But it sounds just very Turkish and it sounds very Greek. Whereas there's another song which could sound like it could be played in like a coffee shop or something in New York or whatever.
Yeah, cool.
And so it is a very eclectic, but there are really obvious moments where George's background really stands out
and was that a challenge to? I mean, I don't know if you've done different time signatures on that particular record, but I think around that part of the world, the standard time signature is 7/8. So you ever see a Western person dancing at a Greek wedding? It's all over the place. Was there any challenges with that at all? Or?
Well, not really, because especially when I was living in Leeds, I was playing a lot of jazz music. I was playing in. There was a band called Yoruba I used to play in, which is like a Cuban salsa band, which was quite progressive in terms of...
Yeah, that's all over the place. Yeah. I think it's time signature-wise.
And so I think, mainly because of the stuff I was working on in Leeds, anything to do with that, it's still challenging, obviously, but it's just down to the context, I suppose. But I think if it's well-written, an odd time signature, it doesn't become that noticeable, if that makes sense.
It's interesting, yeah.
I think if it really stands out that something's in, like... an odd time, then it just feels a bit uncomfortable to listen to, you know, until you're familiar with it. But things like odd time signatures they still have their challenges, but then it's like I say, it's just down to context. I think context is everything with
it's great. So when are you looking to release that?
Maybe we haven't actually talked about it yet. I think maybe April, possibly.
Oh, soon.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
You got a title for it yet?
No. Okay. It's been a discussion between like me and my housemates. Anytime I get a chance to sit down with someone, I end up talking about it because I just want to hear other people's ideas. But it's just so hard to come up with something that doesn't sound pretentious or cheesy. No.
Good luck with that one. In regards to the 1975 second album, so you then got involved in a couple of songs on the second album as well in the touring. What was your fondest memories of recording that second album? Because it's such a difference from the first album for me. I was like, listening to it last week, and it sounds like it's a band matured like 10 years in that time period. And I wondered if that was reflective, if that was a conscious effort from the band, you know, at all? To sound a bit more reflective.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's definitely a representation of where they are as a band, or where they were whilst they were writing it. I think they... Because a lot of people feel pressured when it comes to writing a second album, obviously. And when you think about their debut album, they wrote it whilst they were in their... Some of the music when they were 18 or 19 years old, and they had all the time in the world to write their debut album, whereas they had about 8 months to piece together their second album.
Amazing effort. Yeah.
But then I think with the band, they really grew into their position and their status very quickly. And I think it's still... Like with anyone else, it would take it. It takes its toll, and there's a lot of strain that goes with it. Because having that kind of exposure at a young age, and for it to happen very quickly, is pretty terrifying. I can imagine.
When you got involved, did you feel any pressure the second time going back into it, going into the studio, thinking, "Well, the eyes of the world are watching now"?
Well, only slightly. But then I think if you're a session musician, you still have obviously you have a lot of responsibility. You have a job to do. But you still want to express yourself and do something that feels good for you as well. But then I remind myself that as much as there is that responsibility there, it's not really about me. I'm serving their music and I'm conveying the things that they want to say in their music. And so I really, going into the second album, I just had an amazing time. They were recording it out in LA which really suited the sound of the album.
Yeah.
And I think if you want to go somewhere to be creative, California is... It's very, conducive for that, and I went in at the kind of the tail end of the process. They'd done a lot of the recording already. I was only there for maybe just over a week.
Yeah.
But I was there. I went into the studio on a couple of occasions where I wasn't playing, just to be around the guys whilst they were writing. And I think there was just a certain ease about it.
Mm.
They still would have felt pressured, I'm sure, but they had this confidence about it, because when you think about their album, it makes a really strong statement. It's incredibly eclectic. It's very powerful. It's lyrically, it just says so much.
It's prolific. It's like 17 tracks on the album.
And so I think if you when you commit to doing, to writing that kind of album, and you have to do it with confidence, you have to do it with conviction.
Yeah.
And I think they knew they were doing it. I think they knew that they were writing something really special that was going to stand out. And so I'm sure they had mixed emotions, but there seemed to be an air of confidence in the studio when I was with them.
Interestingly, I wrote down on my phone that it just sounded like a band completely in the zone, totally confident. So that's really interesting to see that perspective, that marries up. That's really cool. Advice to young musicians playing high-pressure gigs. I know we kind of touched upon this, but, you know, you played Saturday Night Live with Larry David hosting, with Bernie Sanders on there and stuff like that. You were playing keyboards on that particular show. You played lots of high-profile gigs. I know you say you don't have ritual or anything like that, but have you got any advice to people to kind of really focus and perform in the zone without thinking, I'm being watched by a lot of people? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit, it's really hard to switch off from the fact that you're being televised to literally millions of people.
You think that while you're playing it?
Sometimes, yeah. It'll creep into my head and then I'll have to switch off from it. But again, it just goes back to being as prepared as you can, being as relaxed, remembering that you're all in it together.
Yeah.
And it's something that you've worked towards really for your entire life. Like I mentioned, I haven't stopped playing the saxophone since I was 10, or playing music. And so it's, I think when it's really important to you, you do your best to ignore that kind of pressure and you just focus on playing. And plus as well, if you're really well rehearsed with, like, for the 1975, we've played those songs like hundreds of times, and so everyone knows exactly what you're doing. You've got this amazing touring party around you, there's a touring crew, and so when it becomes a slick operation, it gives you peace of mind. So I think if you're working with the right people, it dilutes the nerves a little bit, and you can just enjoy try your best anyway to enjoy the performance.
What was the most surreal gig you played?
I think probably the Pyramid stage at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
Because that was still fairly early on with my time with the 1975, and there was maybe towards the end of the set up to maybe 80,000 people in the crowd, which is definitely the biggest crowd I've ever played in front of live. But then also knowing that it's televised, it's going on BBC iPlayer, it's going to be online for a long time.
I watched it this week.
Yeah,
I watched it this week. There you go. Yeah. So.
And so it is. It's just terrifying. You know, it's really, really scary. But then, the minute you start playing, it's a reminder that you can still actually do it. And I can remember also on some of the earlier bigger shows that I'd done, I can remember thinking to myself, do I dare try, and it sounds so stupid, but I can remember saying, do I dare play well, because I know it's going to feel so awesome and so overwhelming that it might actually get the better of me.
Wow.
And that might sound like a little bit silly,
but it's just a
personal thing that I've genuinely had, where I kind of thought, like, will I actually be able to handle the emotion of doing the gig, and will I actually keep it together
and to
deliver a performance, because it's...
And how did you, or how have you done that? What have you done to make sure that didn't happen?
I don't know. Because the thing is, when you're playing a saxophone, you're physically using your mouth and your face, so you can hide a lot of your emotion. You can physically hide behind the instrument. So it's often just, afterwards, you just, I don't know, you just unload. I don't really know. It's the kind of thing that you do the gig, you walk off stage, and then like later in the day you realize you've done it, because you're just running on adrenaline, and it's hard to be conscious of everything whilst it's happening. It's really bizarre.
One thing that struck me when I see you come on and play, say, Heart Out, it's often the first time on some of the shows I've watched, it's the first time you've walked on stage for the show, and you walk on midway through the song, and it always strikes me as a musician myself that almost every musician wants to come on and just, if they're a drummer, hit their drum kit first, or just strum their guitar to make sure that everything's working, and you don't get the opportunity to do that. Literally, your first note is what's going to be heard. Is there ever any like kind of anxiety thinking, oh, please make sure the sound man's got this right?
Yeah, no, definitely, because there's been a couple of occasions early on where there was a little mishap and, you know, things weren't on, and so I'd come in front of like a festival crowd and my sax would just be muted and then it would come on halfway through or something.
Oh man.
But then that hasn't happened ever on this, and within the past couple of years. It's just on earlier shows that it might have happened once or twice. But yeah, so you can't help but feel worried about that kind of thing. So
yeah.
During Heart Out, I'm warming up right into the second before I walk on stage. I can't hear myself because obviously everything's muted, but I'm making sure that everything's in check.
And it's the sound man that you kind of give him a nod and he unmute it, or is it all programmed?
It might actually be programmed now. I don't know. I'm not very technically minded. You can probably tell. But the thing is, it's like I say, they rehearse with us, and so they know their cues just as well, if not better than me. You know.
Interestingly, there's stages in the concerts where you are not playing for certain periods of time. You know, you come and go. Like, what do you do in between those? Like, is it just massive highs and then kind of like dips, like, no, as you come off? Or
it kind of depends. I think it's if it's a really special show, it stays with you off stage. Yeah. And so stage left with me is Svala, our drum tech, and he's awesome. He's one of the guys who I'm really close to on tour. So obviously he still has a job. He's still watching over George and making sure everything's in check. But I just hang out with Svala and but usually if it is a really special show, that high of being on stage, you take it off with you, and so you just feel awesome. It's great.
Oh, fantastic. Now most people who've appeared on the podcast have been kind of reflecting back on their careers and discussing the career peaks that in many ways you're experiencing right now, certainly in terms of the scale of the shows. How does being in the eye of that storm compare to what you thought the music industry would be like when growing up? How's it different to how you expected?
I think you just realise that anyone, regardless of how famous they are, they're a person, they're a human being, and so there's only really been a couple of times where I've been really starstruck or completely overwhelmed by an experience whilst touring, because the things that I dwell on are maybe just how it actually feels to play the music with the right people, and again it goes back to the people you're with. I think because you could tour the world with, you know, playing arenas and stadiums with you know, a hugely popular band, but if you don't get on well with them, it's not going to feel like a beautiful experience.
Yep.
Whereas if you're on stage with people that are really close to you, and if you have an emotional attachment to some of the music, it comes through in the performance and how you deliver the performance and everything. And so I think it's just down to who you're with and who you work with. And obviously it's still cool to go to, like, say, an after party in New York, or, you know, it still feels awesome to be around these historical venues and meet hugely successful, famous people. But then it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to really gain or grow from it. So I think in terms of what you get out of working in the music industry and how exciting it is, you have to do it with the right people.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it isn't exciting, and you'll be exhausted. And as much as I get, you know, pretty tired with traveling and jet lag, I can remind myself of where I am and who I'm with, and it immediately puts me in a different frame of mind, and I can stop whinging about it, or, you know. And so it's just down to the people. I think it's that simple, really.
We've had guests in the past reflecting back on their career who said that one particular guest, John Stewart's fantastic episode 16, who was the band called Stephen, said that he works with a lot of young musicians now, and he says that, this is a quote from him, but basically fame is a mental health condition, and that it's such an unusual and weird thing for a person to go through that often a lot of people turn to drugs and alcohol and that kind of classic rock and roll behaviour, and it's actually self-medicating and just trying to handle the craziness of what's going on. So I'm interested in, you know, what support is there from within the industry to look out for our greatest young artists whose every move is now documented? You know, there's paparazzi, all that kind of stuff, everything, you know, we live in the Twitter generation where people literally, I've just seen this person here. You know, we've had instances for many, many years of, you know, people really going off the rails, and look at Amy Winehouse a few years ago. You're in the middle of that right now, or got kind of a great vantage point on that. What support is there, and could more be done?
I suppose more could be done, because I can't think of, you know, it's not as if there's like a helpline.
No, yeah.
like a Rockstars Anonymous or something like that. It's there's nothing really like that at all. But I think, I don't know, because I think the kind of rock and roll excess and everything, and it's just becoming a little bit embarrassing now and antiquated, and it's just really, it's just a very predictable thing to see. And it's not that it's not happening or affecting people, but I mean, I haven't seen it happen really amongst the people that I work with anyway, which I'm, you know, very grateful for. But I think I like to think anyway that it's becoming slightly more cleaner and healthy working, you know, in this kind of industry, and it's not what it used to be, and I think people have kind of grown out of that kind of thing. But then again, I think it's so. I think any you know, something to do with anything to do with mental health, it's probably down to just the intensity of the exposure these days and the immediacy of everything online. You know, you could say the wrong thing and someone will document it. Like, you know, a 15-year-old can be given the platform to say something, and it could be latched onto by literally thousands. So, yeah. And there's these role models these days who, you know, I mean, I can't think of, the only example I can think of is Kim Kardashian, and it's not that I want to call her out or anything, but the people who have that kind of fame,
yeah,
they're given this huge platform to say something, and it's often the wrong thing, or if it maybe it's maybe they're saying the right thing, but it's misinterpreted by so many young people, because you can see anything now on your phone. You can literally find anything online these days, and so I think it's maybe it's down to someone's message being completely misinterpreted that it can really be very damaging mentally to people, and so I suppose more definitely could be done, but I think it has to be done internally, and again, just working closely with the right people and having them around with you, especially if you're traveling and touring the world, you can't be working with people that aren't right for you, or maybe if they're going to encourage you to indulge in things that are unhealthy and damaging, it's, you know, it's just going to be a downward spiral. But I'm not really sure. I mean,
does the music industry care about the artist? I mean, or are they a commodity that, oh, there's a band that are doing very well at the moment and they're let's, you know, give them everything they want, but, you know, when the new flavour of the month comes out, people don't care about it. I think that's what a lot of our artists who reflect back on their career felt, and they might have been maybe a bit kind of long in the tooth about that kind of thing, but do you think that's the case from where your perspective is?
I think maybe sometimes things can be a little bit contrived, and so someone will say that they absolutely adore you and love you, but then ultimately it's the things, it's the idea of you that I think people invest in. And so, you know, I think, I mean, it's not that I shouldn't use myself as an example, because I'm not really a famous person at all.
But you're in close proximity to huge fame. Yeah.
I'm affiliated with people, but I've found that people seem to like the idea of what I'm doing rather than the actual reality of it, which is just bullshit. It's
alarming,
stupid,
isn't it?
You know, yeah.
And it must be difficult meeting people who are like that and don't actually care about the music very much.
Of course,
just,
yeah.
You met Taylor Swift, you know, that kind of stuff.
Exactly,
you
know,
yeah. Play it, baby.
So in a song called Women, Matt sings, you try dreams, it's harder than it seems. What are some of the touring pressures we don't see, and what are some of the pressures that we don't see being in the role that you're doing?
I think maybe delivering a performance that's amazing, regardless of where you are, of what you've done that following day. You might have just got off a flight 2 hours before you go on stage or something. Or because I hate the idea of music not feeling good to play, or like I said before, I like being nervous. That's the thing, I really like feeling the pressure of something, the responsibility of having to go and do it, and so when I don't feel that, it really does get to me. I hate it. So I think maybe I've put a lot of pressure on myself to be in that frame of mind, regardless of how extensive the travel has been. Or
what are your shortcuts to that frame of mind then? So if you are knackered and you're not really feeling it, and you're in the wrong time zone, you're jet lagged, how do you
Honestly, probably listening to the right kind of music beforehand. And a lot of the people that I'm inspired by, they're not rock stars, and they're incredibly gifted, quite intellectual musicians. And so they would never go on stage feeling uninspired, because they're so focused on what they do. So if I listen to someone like Bob Reynolds, who's one of my favorite saxophone players, again, who comes from a jazz background but plays used to play with John Mayer.
Oh, right.
That's how I found out about it.
My next question's about John Mayer.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, go on.
And so when I think about those guys, I can't ever imagine them going on stage and kind of thinking, "Oh, this is a bit shit, isn't it?" You know, they're always so focused, and they're so admirable that they're the people I want to try and become.
Yeah.
And so I try to check out their music, or I just try, even if it's just a really positive or funny conversation with someone in the crew or in the band. It just if I just laugh for a few seconds, and it kind of shifts something in my mind and how I feel. But then again, it's very rare that I find that I'm not excited to go and play with the 1975. Like very, very, very rare. But then again, occasionally it does happen because I'm a person, and sometimes I don't feel good, and I can't help it. You know?
On the subject of John Mayer, you said that his third album, Continuum, is that right? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, on his third album, Continuum, you said no album means more to me than that album.
Yeah.
How did that album develop your love of music, or why does that music, why does that particular album land with you so much?
I think it's just the basis of how it sounds and the sentiment of a lot of the songs. It's all very clear. The production is amazing, and the musicianship is incredible. Like Pino Palladino and Steve Jordan,
right?
Rhythm section.
Cool. Yeah. Pino's amazing bassist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And then at the time, I think I would have been maybe 19 or 20 years old, and so I would have been at music college. It was a very inspiring time. And I just think with an album like Continuum, there's a lot to talk about, and you can share it with your friends. And also, that's what happened. It became an album that was shared amongst so many of my really close friends that it reminds me of so many people. And then also seeing it live was when I first saw Bob Reynolds live.
Right, okay, wow.
And so I think it's mainly just it's the first album that really moved me lyrically, and then for it to be matched with amazing musicianship that could directly influence what I was doing and what I wanted to become. I think that's maybe why it stood out to me so much.
Amazing answer, thank you. You offer saxophone tuition via Skype to people who have, you said, of any musical ability across the globe. There's plenty of great musicians who made bad teachers, and there's plenty of great teachers who were bad musicians. What challenges do you find with teaching?
Well, so far it's finding students that are genuinely into music, because a lot of people acquire an instrument because they might get one for Christmas or something, or they might be pushed by their parents or teachers to do something, and so you're sitting in, you know, one-to-one with them in a room, trying to, you know, you just want them to be enthused by what they're learning, but often that's not the case. And so and for me, it's something I can't imagine, you know, taking saxophone lessons and not being excited about what I can learn. So it's really frustrating when there's something really simple that you're trying to, you know, discuss with someone and they just don't want to hear about it. So I think it's again, people dwell on the idea of how cool it would be to play an instrument, and the reality of it is that it takes a lot of hard work over a long period of time.
Yeah.
I think too many people think they can just go and buy a guitar for £100 from, like, you know, from Argos or something, plug it in, and then sound like Eddie Van Halen within a week or something. When, you know, it's like anything, it takes decades to become a master of an instrument. I still feel like I've got so far to go. And
so could that be because the challenge is there is that it's perhaps working with kind of real beginners, maybe. Do you have any kind of intermediate students or kind of people excelling as well?
But the thing is, even with I love teaching absolute beginners when they do the work. You know what I mean? For example, there's a 10-year-old boy that I'm teaching called Stanley up in Newcastle, and he loves music. He's really passionate about it, and he's in a band with his friends at school. He's got this amazing family that are really encouraging, and they're very excited about him discovering these new things like music or dancing or whatever it is. And so he already has this very creative mind, and I think he's very influenced by musicians that are older than him that are doing cool things. And so I'm more than happy to teach anyone, you know, regardless of if they're an absolute beginner or not. I just want to see them be excited about it. And so it's very hard to encourage that and to get that out of someone if they're just not really into it.
I'm
I think find like-minded people, find people that are better than you, and surround yourself with them constantly. And I think be willing to invest a lot of time doing a lot of hard work, because you might be given a shortcut. You might have a set of circumstances where you know the right people who can get you there very quickly. But I think if you haven't done the groundwork, then you'll not benefit from any shortcut, really, because you'll be trying to pose as something brilliant, and really you haven't run the race to become successful or great or something. I think it's that simple. Work your ass off and be willing to invest literally 15 years before anything significant happens. You have to be willing to wait that long before you get a break that feels very genuine and sincere with the right people. Otherwise, you might get something sooner, but it might not last at all. You know, I think it has to be right, and it has to be with the right people.
Fantastic advice. And you've obviously done some amazing stuff at a very young age. What specific ambitions do you have left? You must have many, I'm guessing. You've hit a lot of the peaks that a lot of people might want to do. But what ambitions do you have left?
I think it'd be great to become more of an artist and a musician in my own right. A lot of the exposure I've gained has been working with a huge pop band, which I wouldn't have changed it for the world. But it would be awesome to do my own tours in smaller venues and bars or jazz clubs and
Ronnie Scott's.
Yeah, and just to have a body of work which is my own and that people are genuinely into, and that I know that they're genuinely into, not just, again, coming back to the idea of what it might be, because it's associated with 1975. And so for the time being, I'm totally fine with that, but further down the line, it would be great to be, you know, recognised as a solo saxophonist, as a solo artist.
Final question, what fears do you have for the music industry, and how might they be addressed?
I think music's written too fast, really, and I think it lacks just anything that's genuinely moving. It's very, very rare that I'm moved by a new pop band these days. There might be something exciting or cool or very sexy about it, but it's very, very rare that I'm genuinely moved by a live performance by a new artist. And there are exceptions. I saw Kendrick Lamar at a festival in Spain,
Benicassim.
And it was amazing. It was insane. And I saw, you know, Kanye West at a Meadows Music Festival in New York, and it was amazing. It was so striking that, you know, you can say whatever you like about Kanye, but there were real moments in that set where it was just insanely powerful.
Wow.
And the energy in the crowd was amazing. But really, it's hard to pick out people that are genuinely awesome, you know, that you can become very popular these days by being a part of a scene or something, and I get it. I get why young people are excited about it, and, you know, so maybe it is cool that a 16-year-old who, for whatever reason, they feel attached to something, even if it's not very cool, genuine music, that at least they have that kind of vice or something to latch onto. It's awesome. But then, in terms of an industry, in terms of creativity, I think there needs to be more genuine artists that have something that they're actually saying in their music, where lyrics matter, and where musicianship on the recordings as well as live really has something to say, and where that really matters. Because it seems like a rarity these days, which is bizarre, because it doesn't really happen in other industries. You're not going to get, you know, like a plumber to come and fix your bathroom who just kind of doesn't do any of the groundwork, just shows up, and suddenly he's a plumber and you pay him, and there'll be someone else in the background who does all the hard work and who's just kind of left out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
it doesn't happen anywhere else where people can get away with being a little bit of a facade, and it's a shame. And of course, I don't want to be putting a downer on the industry, because there are, I suppose I'm talking about the upper echelon of pop music, because there are literally hundreds and thousands of great artists that still tour the world, who still have a fan base big enough to do that, and they write great music. There's a guy called Alan Stone, who I love, absolutely love. He's a soul vocalist from Washington State in the US. Amazing live band who he works closely with in the studio to write new music, and live he's just the most entertaining guy ever, and his music is genuinely moving, and it's soul music. It just feels great to sit and listen to, and to witness it live is such a spectacle. And so maybe there should be more Alan Stones in the world of music, because I think it would just change things for the better. It would be amazing. So I just want to be moved more by music, by pop music.
Great answer. Okay, well, thank you for coming on. I mean, you're genuinely playing on songs that are going to be played at weddings and retrospective club nights in 20 or 30 years' time, and are creating soundtracks to people's youth as we speak. Keep up the good work. Good luck to the 1975 at the Brits, at the Grammys, Madison Square Gardens. That's going to be amazing. Get that next EP out soon in April. We look forward to hearing that. We're dying to hear that. And let's start a campaign now to get you to play Local Hero at St. James's Park as the players run out. So thanks for your insight and reflections on episode 28 of the Stage Left podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and thanks for being such a top guest.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
For more episodes featuring the likes of Steve Cropper on writing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, Tony Visconti on recording David Bowie's final album Black Star, Cone McCaslin of Sum 41, Jennifer Batten, who's Michael Jackson's guitarist for 10 years, Kieran Pepper of The Prodigy, Billy Burnett of Fleetwood Mac and Bob Dylan's band, and Shane Keister, Elvis Presley's pianist, and many, many more, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, and check us out on Instagram as well. We'll see you at the end of next month.